Well, hello everybody and welcome to another edition of the Total Rugby League Show. This week, we're going to be looking ahead to the World Cup finals this weekend in the men's, women's and wheelchair competitions as we're joined by League Express editor Martin Sadler and Rugby League writer Richard De La Riviere. Well, welcome back everyone to another edition of the Total Rugby League Show. Richard and Martin back with us 2 weeks after the last show where we were catching up ahead of the quarterfinals. And here we are catching up ahead of the big finals taking place this weekend in Manchester for the women's, the men's and the wheelchair. We'll get to all three finals shortly. But welcome to the show, Martin and Richard. Firstly, let Marty catch his breath because he's only just got here. But Richard, just your overall thoughts, where are we at now?
Well, from a very selfish point of view, I'm absolutely delighted because I've managed to get a ticket for the wheelchair final. I offered somebody a kidney on Twitter and it came good. So absolutely delighted with that and I can't wait. As for the two semi-finals that we lost, the men's and the women's, I mean, I actually really enjoyed watching games that mattered so much that went, particularly the men's, that went right to the wire. And I know we lost both, but it was so good to just watch games in big stadium, you know, in a big stadium, a big crowd that mattered so much going out on the BBC. And for once all in my life, you know, my friends on social media who don't really follow it were watching it and engaging with it. And it really has been a wonderfully successful tournament from that point of view. I've had friends who've never watched rugby league who are messaging me saying, isn't this fantastic? All three versions. And I just think that's great. I mean, I'm sure we'll pick the bones out of the defeats as we go along, but what a great weekend of rugby league.
Yeah, those two semi-finals in the men's semi-finals certainly did live up to the billing.
Well, they were entertainment of the highest order, Ben, weren't they? And Richard's absolutely right. Both games were absolutely thrilling. I mean, you know, it would have been nice to see the Kiwis get to the final. And it, of course, it's the old deja vu feeling with England losing in the semi-final. I actually went into that game with a sense of apprehension, you know, the England-Samoa game, because you know from past experience that it's never going to be easy for England. We might have scored 1,000 points against Samoa in the first game, but none of that mattered, did it, when it came to the semi-final. And even when Samoa kicked off and Dom Young caught the ball with a foot in touch to win a penalty from the halfway line, I still wasn't confident that it was going to be England's night. And of course, that's how it turned out to be. And it was an absolutely wonderful game, thrilling. It had everything, great skill, you know, drama, everything you want in a sporting context, except the right results. And that does count for quite a lot, doesn't it, really?
I mean, Richard, I said to Martin on the last show that this World Cup needs England in the final. I'm not too sure now after this past weekend with that semi-final, because that is going to be a match, regardless of the result, which does live long in the memory. So,
well, I don't really agree, because, I mean, imagine if the women's Lionesses in the soccer hadn't got to the final.
Yes.
They may have lost in a great semi-final, whoever they were playing, but, you know, we do need to win one of these things one day. I made the point on Twitter that it was actually calamitous, and someone really pulled me up on that. And I know it's a hyperbolic word, but I do think that, you know, we have these great World Cups, but we do need to win one. We do need to win one soon. And I've just been saying to a mate, however good you are, however good the Australians are, there's always one bad performance in them. And they've got them out of their system before the final, men's and the women's, in both their games against New Zealand. There's always one bad performance. In 2008, they saved it for the final and they lost. In 2000, it was against Wales and obviously they came through. But however good you are, there's always one bad performance. And I just can't believe that it's never against us in the final when it really matters. And it will be one day. I think we can win a World Cup. I think Super League will always be a long way behind the NRL, but I think we can win a World Cup. But it's very, very fine margins, and we're just, you know, again on the wrong side of it. But I think we can get to a final, and I think we can win one.
It was funny though. I mean, I'd love to try and understand the psychology of the England team and why they did fall below par against Samoa last Saturday, because, you know, we had been very impressive, hadn't we, for all the games before then, particularly against Papua New Guinea, when we blitzed them in the first half, you know, when some people had said the Kamuls would give us a very good game. And yet we didn't seem to fire in that semi-final. And I just wonder whether it was partly because we'd had it too easy in all the previous games, including the Samoa opening game, And the players hadn't had to struggle in any game at all in the tournament so far. So when they came up against a team that could match them, they didn't quite know how to respond. And I think it was typified in the Golden Point part of the game where Jack Welsby and Sam Tomkins made two mistakes. Welsby's mistake was rescued by Elliot Whitehead charging down a field goal attempt, but then Sam Tomkins passed the ball forward. I mean, what a time to make a mistake like that. And I don't know whether it was tiredness on Sam's part or just excessive anxiety, but whatever the reason was, it was a forward pass and it was given in England's own half of the field. It gave all the initiative to the Samoans. And of course, they weren't going to let us escape twice, were they? So, you know, it was just so desperately disappointing. And that's it. It was it had all the sort of the bells ringing from 2013 when we had that Sean Johnson try in the last minute of the game that dispatched us from that tournament. And it was funny, coming into the League Express office on Sunday morning was pretty miserable feeling, really, because, you know, we'd seen it so many times before, Ben. And I think, you know, take us quite a bit of time to recover, I think.
And Richard, just to say, the last time we met, we were talking about Sean Wayne's squad selection and that kind of thing. And the ironic thing is, we said that he's picked a squad that's got character and is dependable and has got experience. I mean, I'm no sports psychologist, but there's lots of factors in this, isn't it? It's a semi-final. It's in front of a big crowd. Like Martin said, maybe the level of the competition, the group stages didn't prepare us. But one thing we have to say is Samoa got better as the tournament progressed. I think we outlined what the factors were for that potential to happen in the last show, that they stood firm.
Yeah, I mean, basically, when Martin made that point about how we beat them so easily in the first game and then we had it quite easy against Papua New Guinea, when I made the point that Australia always have one bad performance in them, it's normally because they've had it too easy. So in 2008, when they lost the final, they'd had the easiest World Cup possible up till then and they weren't match hardened. Samoa were match hardened and we weren't. And that often does count. Often if you get a tough semi-final and win it, that puts you in a great position for the final because you're then playing at the intensity already that you need. But your point about Sean and his selections, I mean, yeah, I think I praised him to the hilt, didn't I, for picking some of the guys that people were questioning. And then a couple of them did off poor matches in the semi-final. So it just shows that none of us are experts. Easy to get carried away with the good performances, and then you have to pick the bones out of the mistakes that they make. But
this is it, though. Sport is sport, isn't it? Happens all the time. Yes.
Martin's point about our performance in Golden Point, I think you'd have to say that's the worst Golden Point performance I've ever seen. And not just the actual Golden Point, but the 60 seconds before the last 60 seconds of normal time, which is essentially Golden Point. Elliot Whitehead makes that big break and then just panics and throws the ball on the inside. When we still had 25 seconds, one more drive to the post and a drop goal, and we should have won it there and then, but he threw the ball away. And these are great players making these mistakes, so that's just the pressure that's on.
Yeah.
NRL players, though, are much more used to Golden Point. You know, as kids, they'll have watched Golden Point because they've had it for nearly 20 years now, whereas we've only had it for 3 or 4. So it's not surprising that a Southern Hemisphere team will have more nous in a Golden Point situation against a Northern Hemisphere team.
That's it, isn't it, Martin? I mean, I can only think of... obviously the Salford Hull KR game many moons ago, that was pretty epic stuff, but we don't really have those pressure moments week in, week out, do we?
No, we've had some of them, but not many. I think Richard's absolutely right that the teams from the NRL probably have a Golden Point strategy. You know, they probably think about it more than we do. For us, it's a bit of an add-on, isn't it, to the game? And, you know, it's a bit like the England football team when penalty shootouts first came in. You know, the Germans had probably worked it all out and we just played on the hoof, really. And inevitably, they beat us every time. And it's a bit like that, I guess. But, I mean, it's funny, you know, we can talk about all we like about ifs and buts and maybes and so on. And, I mean, I would have liked to see Kai Pearce-Paul playing in that game on Saturday with his offloading skills. I thought we just perhaps lacked a little bit in that part of the game. And I would have liked Andy Akers on the bench, you know, to when it wasn't going great for Michael McIlhoran. But, you know, that's all in the past now. And it doesn't matter anymore, does it, really? It's all been done and dusted. And it's Samoa who are in the final. So I think we ought to focus a bit on Samoa and say, well, it's an incredible thing for them. And the funny thing is, I mean, people are saying, well, they're the complete underdogs going into this game. But if you actually look at their team that played on Saturday, out of the first six players named in their team from 1 to 6, four of them are Penrith players who played and won in the NRL Grand Final. So, you know, to say that they're actually underdogs, I mean, you know, they probably are, but not by that much. And, you know, they could potentially give Australia a real great game. And obviously, I hope they do. And it's been great to see over the last week or so the Samoans in all parts of the world celebrating their team getting to this final, not just in Samoa, but obviously in Auckland, which is a big Samoan city within New Zealand. But even in parts of the United States and other parts of the world, you know, I noticed there was a parade in, I think it was Los Angeles or San Francisco, where Samoan fans were driving down the expressway, waving Samoan flags and so on. So, you know, you can't help but be happy for them while obviously being very sad for us.
Yeah, Richard, we need to hype up the underdog status of Samoa for this final, because the film rights are going to make a fortune, clearly. So we need to really hype this up. I mean, just touching upon the quarterfinals, just before we touch upon the other semi-final. I mean, we made our predictions for those quarterfinals. They all went pretty much as we thought. We said Tonga and Samoa would be close, but Fiji ran New Zealand very, very close as well. We said about how battle-hardened Samoa was, but that semi-final against Tonga certainly helped, I'm going to say, give them a bit of a springboard for the game at Arsenal.
Yeah, it did. I mean, the Fiji performance woke the New Zealanders up for them to play very well against Australia. And then, of course, the Samoa-Tonga gave the Samoans the platform they needed, whereas England and Australia had the easy quarterfinals in terms of the scoreboard, and then underperformed in the semi-final. So there's definitely something in this. But if you want to start your film off with me predicting that Samoa don't have a chance, then that's fine, because they don't. They ain't going to win. And Australia will win by at least 20, 24, something like that. Maybe it might even be more of a blowout. Not just because you look at them on paper and Australia are just too good, but also you kind of feel that Samoa, getting where they are now, they're probably pretty chuffed with this. They won't think it, but subconsciously, maybe whatever they do now, they're going to go home as heroes. Whereas Australia are here to win the World Cup and nothing else matters. So I can't see it. I can't see it at all. I'd happily lay 10-1. I can't see it.
After the Lord Mayor's parade is the sporting saying, isn't it, Martin?
You know, as I say, they've got some very good players. Whether they can put it together for a second week in succession is something we're going to find out, isn't it? We can't really say. And of course, it is. True that favourites don't always win, but the trouble is when the favourite's Australia, they normally do win. So there are not many examples apart from 2008. And maybe they did against Tonga, you know, a few years ago when Tonga beat them in Auckland. But, you know, that wasn't a World Cup game. That was a one-off game. And, you know, the Australians... I mean, the interesting thing about the Australians, though, is that some of their players haven't really fired yet, have they? You know, Nathan Cleary, I thought he would win the Golden Boot this year before the tournament started. And quite frankly, he's not come anywhere near it. You know, and there are other players of theirs who have not shone yet either. I would suggest, for example, Latrell Mitchell is, you know, he's been fairly quiet and not making quite the impression that I thought he would make. So, you know, you never know. I mean, having said that, you know, we can now expect Cleary to have an absolute blinder in the final, and Mitchell as well, probably. It would be just like them to do that, wouldn't it? And as Richard says, run up a big score against the Samoans. But I hope it doesn't happen. I mean, I really hope, and, you know, against hope, that it's a very close game and that it's a very small margin at the end. But, you know, we'll soon find out, won't we?
Yeah, I did use that phrase in after the Lord Mayor's parade, but you could have said Tonga was that. So if Samoa gets to the final and wins the final after beating Tonga, England and Australia to do so, then they'll have earned it, won't they?
They certainly will.
Richard, just to touch upon Australia and how they got there, that game, we mentioned the game at Arsenal, how good that was, an advert for rugby league. But the game at Elland Road between Australia and New Zealand was epic. It really was, wasn't it? And what a try from Madgo Carr.
Oh, unbelievable. Imagine Usain Bolt running as quickly as he can in a 100-metre final and then having to catch a rugby ball from out of the sky and score a try, because that's basically what happened. It was absolutely magnificent, wasn't it?
And his pace was at its maximum throughout. Yeah
it was. That's what I mean. There was no, he didn't sort of stop. Incredible. The whole game, though, was just absolutely incredible from start to finish. But people will remember it for the Adokar try. One of the most famous tries ever scored in Australian Rugby League history is Steve Gearin in the 1980 Grand Final. If you look it up on YouTube, it's quite similar, but it's nowhere near as good. Adokar has just produced something that is five times better than the famous Steve Gearin try. It was just that good. But it was one of those games where you just expected Australia to take control and score two or three tries and kill the game off. And although they won, it remained a contest right till the end. And there was that period where it looked like New Zealand were out on their feet with about 10 or 15 to go. And then they still managed to get upfield and get over the try line, although it was disallowed. It was just a sensational game.
The Kiwis were really unlucky. I mean, they had a couple of tries disallowed, didn't they? And I think the decisions were correct decisions. But they were just unlucky. There was just one very marginal offside that stymied them. But the thing about the Australians is they don't make those sort of mistakes, do they? You know, you find that the Australians, when the ball is kicked through and they score a try, they're never found to be offside, you know, because they never are. They're just that tiny bit more professional than anybody else in making sure they do the right thing. And, you know, good luck to them. That's a great thing. And we all need to emulate them and then surpass them. And I thought we were in with a great chance of doing that this year. Although I've got to say that if we'd played Australia in the final and played like we did against Samoa, we would have had to improve dramatically on that performance. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I don't know how the sales of Samoan flags are going on Amazon at the minute, but I'm imagining there's going to be plenty of Samoan supporters at Old Trafford on Saturday night. Richard's already said what are the chances. Marty, what are the chances?
Well, Richard said it's 10-1 against Samoa. I think I'd probably go about 4-1 against. I think they may 4 or 5-1. I'm not sure I'm quite as pessimistic as Richard, but obviously I think Australia are going to win. And I really can't. I mean, as I say, my big fear is that some of the players like Cleary and Mitchell, who haven't really shone so far, will choose this game to have blinders. And, you know, if they do, I think that's just about game over, isn't it? But let's hope that they don't.
That's the Men's World Cup big good luck to both Samoa and Australia this weekend. Now, let's go to the Women's World Cup. And Richard, England just falling short once again in the World Cup. What's that now? The fourth consecutive semi-final. It was closer than the last one, though, against New Zealand.
Well, it was, but I've always had a theory that when it comes to International Rugby League, home advantage is probably worth about 20 points. And I think if that game had taken place in the Southern Hemisphere, based on the ease in which New Zealand were winning the ruck from about the 15th minute onwards, I think it probably would have been a big score. I'm not going to take anything away from the players. All 24 players in that England squad are top quality players, and there's probably 10 or 12 more, you know, who are of a similar standard. But New Zealand were very, very big, and that's what everybody was pointing out on social media. Wow, that New Zealand team is very big. And our coach had deliberately picked a small pack, and he's always picked small packs. It's his thing. You know, you look at his lineups since he became England coach in 2018, and Craig Richards has always picked at least one second rower at prop, and maybe only had one prop on the bench. And if you're going to offer a critical analysis, I think you've got to not just do it with hindsight. You've got to have called it beforehand, and you've got to be consistent, and you've got to be right. And I think I tick all those three boxes, because I called it 3 or 4 weeks ago in League Express. He's picked a team that was too small. He left behind the number one enforcer type prop, Shani Crowell. He then didn't pick Danielle Anderson in the 17, who was the best player in the playoffs in the grand final, and she's a prop at Leeds. It's just too small. And there was just a mismatch in size that was insurmountable. And based on that team selection, we couldn't win. And that's ultimately what it comes down to.
And Martin, I mean, in that Women of Steel documentary on the BBC, you saw Craig agonising over who to select in the squad. And That's what they're there for, coaches. They have to make those calls. Would you agree, Richard, that that's probably
well, Richard's the case. Made a very eloquent case. I mean, and Richard's absolutely right that he did call it before the tournament began, and it's worked out in very much in just the way that he suggested that, you know, in, and it was clear. I mean, I was at York on Monday night. What a great night that was, by the way. It was so great to see a stadium almost full, more than 7,000 people there. Fabulous crowd, fabulous atmosphere, and actually an incredibly spirited performance by England, I thought. And, you know, they took the lead with the brilliant Fran Goldthorpe, who's one of my favourite rugby league players, of men or women. And, you know, we were filled full of optimism for that first 15 minutes or so. But then, as Richard says, the Kiwis started to impose their size and power. And they just had more of those qualities than we had. I think we could certainly match them for skill. But I just don't think ultimately rugby league is a power game. And you have to stock up with power in the middle of the field before you can actually exploit the gaps that then start to appear through your back line. So, Richard's right. It would have been great to see England getting to the final. But again, I think England would have been beaten comfortably by the Australians on Saturday if they'd got there. But of course, New Zealand only lost 10 points to 8 to Australia just a week ago. So I think that will be the best final. And, you know, it would be great. Again, you know, I suspect that the Australians might just be too strong for the Kiwis, but my goodness, it's going to be a great game. And I'm very much looking forward to it.
Richard, one of the things that I've got circled here on my little crib sheet is how do we close the gap? I was going to say, I mean, Craig came in 5 years or so ago, and that was his task to close that gap. And I think that gap has closed, but it was such a mammoth gap. It was always going to be an uphill task for this World Cup. How do we close that gap? Is it a case of more investment in the women's game? We mentioned last time about Leeds. Do we need players to go to the NRL? Do we need more tours of, like we saw against PNG? Is that how we just continue to do this? It's time.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, as I said, in the men's, I think Super League will always be behind the NRL. And I think that's the case with the women. But if you get your decisions right and you get a few other things right, you can beat them at representative level. I mean, Queensland win state of origins, despite the Queensland competition for many years being nowhere near as good as the Sydney competition. You can do it in a representative stage. I'm a bit worried that everyone's going to get a bit sidetracked by the big red herring that is professionalism. Leeds are paying match payments. Mm-hmm. None of those players are going to become full-time rugby league players. So I very much hope that Craig is right, that other clubs follow suit, because those girls deserve to be paid. But, you know, none of them are going to be earning big money so they can jack in their jobs. That's not going to happen. We're a long, long, long away from that. So I hope they do get paid, but we don't want it to become too much of a red herring. It would be good to see a few players. I understand that Georgia Roach might have potentially had some interest from an Australian club. I've heard there's some good money on the table potentially, and I think that NRLW clubs might look at quite a few of our players, particularly some of the younger ones. I mean, Holly Doddy's absolutely world-class, the second rower. She is fabulous. I thought she was our best player in the World Cup. Fran Goldthorpe, Caitlin Beavers, Georgia Roach, they could all go to the NRLW and become even better players than they are. So sure, that's another thing. We could do with another couple of teams matching the standards of Leeds, York and St Helens. And I think Wigan will be stronger next season. And Warrington getting promoted look like that, you know, they've got a good squad and they're certainly investing in the women's game. So we need those two clubs to hit the heights of Leeds and Saints in New York. And that'll help a lot.
Well, I can certainly see English players going to the NRLW, Richard, because, of course, the NRLW is expanding. So they will be looking for
more
players of the quality that they require. And I think Georgia Roach, I think she's a really great player and would fit in very easily into the NRLW, plus the other players that you've mentioned. It would be a shame to lose them from our competition, but obviously if they can become full-time players over there, then who wouldn't be attracted to doing that? I mean, you know, they'd be crazy not to think about it. And I would be very surprised if several of them didn't go. You know, and the trouble is, you know, with the Australians now going full time with the NRLW teams, the gap between us and them is only going to grow. if we don't go full time and there isn't the money in our game that would enable us to do that. You know, as Richard says, it will be match payments from Leeds next year, hopefully from other teams as well. But that's a long way from being full time, whereas they'll be training, you know, full time and they'll just gradually get better.
That's where, if you develop in a conveyor belt, which, you know, is well and truly underway now in the British game, that conveyor belt has to end somewhere. And maybe that's the short and medium term is it ends in the NRL. And we do what the other Pacific nations do and just piggyback ourselves onto it and win some silverware.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, I thought it was good for the English game that Ellis, Burgess, Morley and all those guys went to the NRL. I never saw that as a bad thing. You know, there's a lot of junior clubs and a lot of amateur clubs now that do have a women's section. So I think Saints and Leeds and York and Wigan and Warrington will still be able to attract players. They've got under-19s teams. They've got good quality under-19s. I went to watch the England Knights play Cook Islands a couple of weeks ago, just before the World Cup started. A lot of young players in that team and they stood up to the Cook Islanders and did well. I've got some figures that might be of interest. The minimum wage in Australia for the NRLW is $13,000. So you divide that by two for English money, so sort of 7.5. So that's the minimum, but obviously that's not a professional person's wage. They get 8,800, I think, for state of origin. So over $4,000. In, you know, British pounds for playing a state. So obviously that's very good money. But the top players, I believe, a couple of them are actually on over 100,000 Australian dollars. So that, I think Isabel Kelly is a full-time professional rugby league player.
And they actually play quite a restricted season, don't they, compared to the men, Richard? And that's an interesting thing because, you know, when we're talking about, you know, the legacy from this World Cup, obviously most people want the legacy to be more international competition. And that's difficult, you know. I spoke to Troy Grant, the chairman of the International Rugby League, at the weekend, and he made it clear that next year there won't be a tour by Australia or New Zealand to this country, but there might be a tour by one of the other nations, you know, for the men's game. But actually, it's a lot easier to organise international fixtures for the women and the wheelchair, for that matter, because there isn't the massive elephant in the room that is the NRL and Super League that dominate virtually the whole year and make it very difficult to organise international rugby league, you know, in the gaps that are left over in the year.
That's
so,
right.
You know, maybe we can see the Australians or even the Kiwi women touring this country next year, you know, either before or after their season gets underway in the NRLW. And that would be great, wouldn't it? I mean, I think people would go to, you know, a three-test series now between England and the women of Australia or New Zealand. And it's funny, actually, that England haven't played Australia this year in the World Cup in either men's or women's tournaments. Yeah. You know, it's strange, isn't it? And I don't think we've played them in the wheelchair either.
No, so, we did in the opener. Can we put in the Ashes? Because
we've
beaten them 1-0 across the three
yes,
formats.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I'd forgotten that game.
So but, we've won. We've won. Good.
We've won the Ashes.
Richard, just before we move on to the final and what are the chances, just a general close about the women's game, because we touched upon it a couple of weeks ago. There's so much good work going on in the domestic competition. As we touched here, there's avenues for either going professional for some of these players in Australia. So this World Cup, in that regard, has put a spotlight on the women's game. There'll be girls who've watched this competition who'll now feel encouraged by what they've seen. And, you know, there's plenty of opportunities at the community level to get involved in this great sport.
Yeah, that's right. I think just apart from England not making the final, I think just positives all the way. But I think we're now at a stage where we now maybe need a bit more sort of critical analysis rather than just saying, oh, you know, isn't it wonderful that women are playing rugby league? So I think we need to move to the next stage. And I think we need to start getting things right. I think the New England coach is going to be Stuart Barrow. I'm hoping to interview him for League Express, and I'm looking forward to hearing what he says. But part of me is very disappointed that the job didn't get advertised to get applications in. And it just makes me wonder that, you know, the men's job will go to someone who's won Super Leagues and Challenge Cups, and the women's game goes to someone who's employed by the RFL and works in their coaching department. And it just makes me wonder whether a whole clean, fresh approach might have been the best way forward, because mistakes were made and Stuart would have been part of that process that made some of those mistakes. So I'm not sure that continuity, but we don't know. Stuart Barron might have very different ideas, because as manager, I'm guessing he wouldn't have had any say in the team selection, and now he will have that. But I just think it has to be seen as a very, very prestigious job. And I think putting adverts out there, inviting applications, you might get applications from NRLW coaches. I believe the Brisbane Broncos NRLW coaches just stood down. I think the St George coach from a year or so ago, I think Daniel Lacey, highly regarded. You know, you don't know. These people might have applied. You might have got Super League men's coaches or Championship men's coaches that would have taken an interest. And I think they should have taken their time and advertised the job and seen what came in. And I think they would do that with the men's game, and I don't see why they don't with the women's game.
I mean, these are questions you'll be asking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope I'll get the chance to interview them. And it'll be interesting to see what the answers are. But I've got a strong piece going into League Express next week with Gemma Walsh, the former England and Wigan captain, pointing a lot of this stuff out.
I think they're going to wait till after the World Cup for an announcement to be made. But, well, those are the views of Richard. Martin, your views?
Well, I bow to Richard's much greater knowledge of the women's game, but I think everything he says makes complete sense. And, you know, there's some interesting questions there for the RFL. Of course, the RFL itself is now advertising for a new chief executive. So I suppose that Ralph Rimmer, who's serving out his time until the end of December, there's some talk that the appointment of a new chief executive has been delayed. So maybe these are questions for the RFL chairman, Simon Johnson, and questions that I think we ought to ask and certainly will do. But yeah, and of course, some interesting questions for the Rugby League's partner, IMG, now, because, you know, we've got them in the background making some quite key decisions in relation to the future of Rugby League. And they must obviously be able to see that the women's game is going to be a very important part of Rugby League's future. And perhaps even, you know, it may well be possible to get some very good commercial sponsorship of Women's Rugby League, maybe even more so than the men's game, because, you know, women's sport is definitely on a high at the moment in a whole range of sports. And commercially, it's got to be a very attractive proposition. So, you know, now I think the England women, even though they didn't get to the final, they've handled themselves extremely well. And I think that's also true of the Australians and New Zealanders too. And the other thing about the women's tournament, if we can just sort of say it, is pay a bit of a tribute to the more minor nations, because, you know, it was great to see Brazil and Canada fighting out a very even contest a week or so ago, with the Canadians just winning by a single score at the end of the game. And, you know, who would have ever imagined Brazil entering a Rugby League World Cup competition? And let's hope that that's the start of something big in that country that might even then embrace the men of Brazil as well. You know, it would be marvellous to think that, you know, we've got a foothold in South America. So there are lots of very positive things about the women's tournament that I think we can take advantage of if IMG are serious about wanting to improve Rugby League's commercial performance, as well, presumably as they are, then the women's game is something they need to look at very closely indeed.
And Richard, just touching upon an interesting thing Craig said in his post-match interview after that semi-final against New Zealand, he was saying how the domestic competition needs to grow on the back of this. It can't just be, you know, the same clubs up at the top. And touching upon the prospects of TV deals down the line and that kind of thing, that needs to happen, doesn't it? And that's where all we can do is wait for time, basically, to develop and get these players developing after being encouraged by this World Cup, hopefully.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, but I think the Super League competition has improved, and I think just naturally will continue to improve. I think a couple of months ago, Wigan's under-19s beat Leeds' under-19s, and by all accounts, Wigan have got an outstanding academy set up with the girls. Now they had a lot of injuries last season, so I think they'll be a lot stronger next season. And like I said before, I think Warrington will be pretty strong as well. So I think we probably will have another year of improvement, and therefore another year of it being the best Women's Super League competition that we've had so far. That's an improvement that will just continue. I was a little bit surprised when Craig made reference to the best players being pulled at two or three of the top clubs, because he's actually been responsible for getting some players to St Helens, like Shona Hoyle from Huddersfield. I actually thought that maybe Warrington might try and entice away a few players. And I just wondered if Warrington could get the checkbook out and offer them a few quid. Because if we're moving into an era where they're going to start getting paid, then why don't we see this? It would be fascinating, and it would create stories. It would create interest. It would create a, you know, for an amount of money that's relative sort of chicken feed to a club like Warrington, they could offer a few grand here and there to some of the Saints players maybe or whoever and get them over and create a bit of interest. Because in the men's game, transfer stories were always the big stories 20, 30 years ago in rugby league. And they're not tied in by contracts. There's no salary cap. So why don't we have a bit of this? I think it would be great fun, and I think it would be affordable for the clubs. And maybe a few players would switch clubs if they got offered a sum of money to do so. So maybe we'll see some of that.
And Martin, just a close. Obviously, this weekend Australia taking on New Zealand. Australia have been unbelievable this tournament. It's going to be tricky, isn't it, for New Zealand this weekend?
Well, it's going to be tough for them, but, you know, they are a tough team. And, you know, I think they've got every chance of... they've probably got more chance in that game than the Samoans have in the men's game against Australia. I mean, obviously, I think Australia will win again. I mean, the Australian women, I think, they're a really athletic team, and they've got all the attributes that you need to be a successful side, you know, whether we're talking about men or women. So I think they'll do very well. But interestingly enough, it was a New Zealand girl who won the women's Golden Boot, Racine McGregor, who actually plays, of course, for the Sydney Roosters. So, you know, that's another NRL person. But it's going to be interesting to watch. And I think what's really interesting about Saturday is how many people turn up to watch the women's final, you know, because obviously I'm not sure what the crowd is going to be as a whole yet for the men's final, but we'll see what sort of an impression this women's tournament has created by how many people actually decide to turn up to watch the women's final. And hopefully it'll be a very significant proportion of the total crowd.
Now, a big good luck to both Australia and New Zealand in that final. But it's now time to head to our final talking point with regards to this Rugby League World Cup. And that takes us to the Wheelchair Rugby League World Cup. And Marty's just made the comment there about leaving an impression. And I think if we're taking one thing away from this World Cup, it's the impact that the wheelchair version of the sport has had. And I'll start with you, Richard. Because you'll go to the final this weekend. I mean, I suggested it's got to be an England-France final, and that's how it's transpired. But getting to this point, the journey this version of the sport has taken, particularly watching it and following it on social media, it's gone to a whole new level after this World Cup, I think.
I could possibly foresee a time when the wheelchair rugby league is bigger than men's rugby league. It's unbelievable, the potential. I've not seen wheelchair rugby union, but my understanding is it just doesn't really work because it's too difficult to replicate the 15-a-side game. But they've managed to replicate the 13-a-side game with the wheelchair because you have a way of playing the ball, you have a way of kicking the ball downfield, you have a way of your six tackles, the tags that's each tackle.
They even have a way of diving over the line.
I know the crossfield kick, as we call it, the high kick to the wing, and someone gets it and scores and comes out. The chair collapses on the ground. We saw one of those in this tournament, didn't we? They have managed to replicate, in the most brilliant way, what rugby league actually is. And it's astonishing. It is absolutely incredible. And I've watched a few games, and every time I've put on social media, you know, watch this. If you're not a rugby league fan, just watch it. And those people that do, they just go, wow, this is absolutely incredible. The growth potential is frightening. There's always been a glass ceiling just above the men's game, and we've never been able to smash through it. I think there's a lot of growth potential with the women's game. The growth potential of the wheelchair game is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. I anticipate a day when these guys are on the front of League Express just for winning a random Super League match, you know, because it does have the potential to become massive. And in my Rugby League Heroes series, I want to interview some of these guys. I really want to do that, you know, pretty soon as well. Because they've obviously got great stories, particularly those like James Simpson, who lost his legs in Afghanistan and now he's playing in the world. It's unbelievable, the story of, is it Jack Brown who has taken this up because his brother was a wheelchair user, so he took this up, so he's able-bodied. And there's stories of relatives in the same team. There's been a team with an uncle and a nephew, brothers, and there's the father-son combination. It's just incredible. The human interest stories that come out of Wheelchair Rugby League are just amazing. But the product itself is just, I'm running out of words, superb, wonderful, incredible, whatever. Oh. I can't wait to go on Friday.
And I think Rich is actually 100% correct here. And Martin, when I look at social media, there's going to be a TV exec who thinks there's mileage in this. Sure.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. And what's amazing is that it's not until now that Rugby League has actually come up with a version of the sport that can be played indoors and that can be a spectacle that's suitable for TV. You know, I mean, obviously, the football has five-a-side football. We can't really replicate that. But now we've found a version of the game that actually is completely suitable for television. And as Richard says, Wheelchair Rugby Union, because, you know, the contrast between the rules of rugby union, you know, in normal rugby union and any indoor version that they might come up with, it's too big a gap to bridge. So Wheelchair Rugby League just seems, you sort of think, well, it was there waiting to be discovered, wasn't it, by somebody? And whoever's put the rules together has done an absolutely wonderful job. And the players have sort of charged into it. It's got all the toughness and hardness that Rugby League on the field has got. It's got the skill that Rugby League on the field has got. And it's got the spirit and endeavour that you require to do well. And the great thing is, Australia are not in the final. You know, that's to top it all, really. Although, you know, I wouldn't bank on that next time we have a Wheelchair World Cup. You know, the Australians will no doubt go home and give a lot of thought to this. But it's great to see England and France. It's great to see France there because they're going to be hosting the next World Cup. And while I obviously would like to see England win the Wheelchair Final, I won't be anything like as upset if France win it as I normally would be, because, you know, we need to boost the French in every way possible before they host the next World Cup in 3 years' time, whether it's wheelchair, women, men or youth. I mean, there are going to be four World Cups next, you know, in 3 years' time in France. So it's going to be it's going to be incredibly exciting. But you know, as Richard says, it's a game to look forward to incredibly on Friday night. And what an opener it's going to be for the grand final weekend. It'll be a full house at Manchester Central. And the great thing is, it's impossible to predict the winner. I think it's going to be the closest of all the three major finals this weekend, to be honest. So, you know, I mean, France may be the slight favourites, but England beat them last time they played each other. So it's going to be a tough game. I don't think France were at full strength on that occasion, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
Now, Richard, we did touch upon how do we grow the women's game after this World Cup. That has to be the question now after this, because you can't look a gift horse in the mouth. This has been a sensational World Cup. How do we build upon this now domestically? Because the wheelchair version of the game actually mirrors the issue with the women's version of the sport as well, in the fact you've got a few clubs at the top who dominate things at the minute. We have to grow that, don't we? And we have to grow the home nations. And look what's happened in France. It's kind of had a knock-on effect with the Spanish team as well. There's players who play in the French game, isn't there? So that's what we need to replicate, and we need to grow from here, don't we?
Yeah, in terms of how to grow, look, I would just say, with my minimal knowledge of this, I would just say it is the most magnificent television spectacle, and we need these games to be on as much as possible, preferably terrestrial. Channel 4 every week, presented by Adam Hills. What would be better than that? That's what we need. I'd also like to see a few people like Jamie James Buchanan and John Wilkin. They're recently retired. They're still very strong, fit guys. Wouldn't it be good if some of those started playing at Super League level in the wheelchair?
Oh, it would. I was going to make that point, Richard. Yes. I mean, you know, you are allowed to have some able-bodied people playing, obviously only a limited number. But it would be great to see ex-players taking it up. Just you know, to see how they go and to see whether they can adapt quickly to the demands of Wheelchair Rugby League. And it would certainly give Wheelchair Rugby League, a lot more publicity, I'm fairly sure. You know,
and of course, it's easy for us to volunteer other people, but I wouldn't do it myself.
I think I'm a bit past it, unfortunately.
I think Spain did have an ex-player. I'm pretty sure they did. Who had a leg injury and therefore took up the wheelchair version. So, but anyway, just a closing thought, and
Just to touch upon the World Cup more generally, Martin, we did have our reservations a couple of weeks ago about the group stages. We covered that off. We talked about how we can improve the Northern Hemisphere competition and that kind of thing. I suppose we'll know more after this weekend where we stand.
Well, it'll be interesting to review the World Cup and to see what lessons we learn from it. And I'll be very interested to see what the BBC concludes about its own coverage and whether it's been happy with the way it's gone. I hope that they have been. I hope that they've been happy with the audiences that have been generated. And I hope that the three tournaments have all been successful as far as they're concerned. And I think there were some mistakes made in terms of the way the groups were created. I think there were some mistakes made in terms of the scheduling. I think there were some mistakes made in terms of venues. It would have been great to see some of the minor games being played at places like York and even Featherstone and so on. So the games were a bit more spread around venues. And I think there were obviously some mistakes made with pricing. I wish they'd made some games that they'd targeted some of the minor games like Scotland v Italy, let's say, to be played on days when on afternoons midweek when they could have invited lots of school kids in for free to cheer on the teams and so on and so forth. And that there should have been a far greater sense of price discrimination where, the big games, okay, let's charge the full going rate, but for some of the lesser games, let's use those as promotional vehicles to get more kids interested in coming to watch the games. So there are all sorts of things that I think could have been done better. But then again, isn't it always easy to be wise after the event? We can all say that we wish that this had happened and that had happened, but only Richard actually was wise before the event, as he wrote, about the women's game in League Express a few weeks ago. So let's hope that some lessons are learned and that, all the tournaments in France in 2025 it's onwards and upwards for all of them.
And Richard, let's talk about France and 2025. There will be some learnings, as there always is from things like this. And I'm sure the French Rugby League have been watching this tournament with great interest. Hopefully those things can be ironed out for France in a few years' time.
Well, I think this World Cup's been the best we've ever had. I'd always said 95 until now, but I think this has surpassed that. And of course, the women and the wheelchair is a major reason for that. So yeah, up to the French to hit these levels and maybe even go past. The criticisms that we made a couple of weeks ago that Martin's just touched upon, they're criticisms that can be very easily ironed out. A lot of problems with rugby league can't be easily ironed out, and with problems that we've never been able to solve. So there's no point banging on about them too much. But the ways that this World Cup wasn't quite perfect are things that can easily be sortable. So I hope they're taken on board in 3 years' time. And what a prospect it's going to be, the Rugby League World Cup in 3 years in 2025. I mean, I can't wait. I'm someone now who's much more interested in the international game than the club game. And I think this World Cup has shown that there's more and more people like that now, that we don't want these loop fixtures anymore. And 10 more club games than they have in Australia. It's just pointless. It's shooting ourselves in the foot.
Ridiculous.
This has got to be the future, that we build the international game, we strengthen the home nations, we go through every single playing squad in this country with a magnifying glass to find everyone who qualifies for any other nation. And we do our best to persuade them to sign up with Scotland or Wales or Ireland or whoever else they might qualify for. And we make those teams as strong as possible, because we've only now got in the Northern Hemisphere one team out of the best eight. And yes, that's England, right, who have now fallen to fourth, potentially fifth. And if we played Fiji in a World Cup, we might not even beat them now, So that's the downside of my argument. If we do take players away from England to strengthen the other ones, we then weaken England. So there's a lot to chew over. But the bottom line is these last 3, 4, 5 weeks have been absolutely amazing. And we have been spoiled rotten, and it's been fabulous.
And Martin, that's the key, isn't it? I mean, IMG and the Super League bosses, they need to have watched this World Cup, because I'm pretty sure those people in the NRL we'll have watched that New Zealand semi-final and gone, oh, that was pretty good, wasn't it? And we need to have more occasions like that with a big crowd and a big TV audience at home. And you can only get that really from International Rugby League.
Yes, it was great to see 28,000 people at Elland Road watching that Australia-New Zealand game, and you know, it made it seem like a very big occasion indeed, and of course, so it was. My immediate disappointment after, you know, and the World Cup hasn't finished yet, but you know, we've now got an England versus France game next year, but it's been arranged for Warrington. Now, I love Warrington. I've certainly nothing against Warrington, but wouldn't it have been good to take that game to France? I would have thought. I mean, it would have been great to announce that as an international weekend with matches between France and England at, you know, men's, women's, wheelchair and youth level, or even PDRL level, for example, to, you know, have a real, make it a real massive weekend of rugby league in France. But instead, we're you know, doing it, you know, we've got a single game in this country. And, you know, I'm not sure that the Rugby Football League and their equivalents across the channel in France have really grasped how to really maximise the legacy from this tournament. And let's be imaginative and creative, and let's keep this link between these different branches of the game, for goodness sake. And let's promote like anything we can the next World Cup to be held in France.
Absolutely. I think we should end on that note. Well, Richard, Martin, a big, big thank you for joining us over these last couple of weeks or so, looking at the Rugby League World Cup for 2021 in the year 2022. I know it's confusing, but historians will make sense of it all. And hopefully this has been a springboard. These tournaments that we've had, this Festival of Rugby League this past month, hopefully it'll be a springboard into the next era of the sport. But Martin, big thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Richard, enjoy your trip out in Manchester on Friday night. Stay out of
trouble. Yeah, thanks very much.
And TotalRL.com, the place to go to for all the latest goings on from the world of rugby league. Martin, just a quick plug for League Express on Monday as well. Lots of coverage for this weekend.
Lots of coverage of all three major finals, plus every other aspect of rugby league that you can think of, Ben. It's going to be an important issue, and we'll see how it goes. But I'm sure you'll find the best coverage in our newspaper, or at least I hope so.
And we've got an interview with Colin Clark as well.
The father of Phil Clark, of course.
Absolutely, very interesting story.
And a great player in his own right.
And people can buy my book, Rugby League, on this day, and that's on eBay.
See that? I didn't even need to prod him this week to do that, Martin.
I was a bit nervous then.
Well, lots of stuff to come. Have a lovely weekend, everybody. A big thank you for joining us for these two shows, and you'll be hearing from us again very soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.